You should have some notes. If you'll take those, what we're doing here is we're assuming that you have a vision, a dream, a goal, something for your church or ministry. So we're not going to talk about how to get one or write one or any of that stuff. We're assuming you've already got it and that you're moving forward with implementing the vision. So our session is called The Vision Pathway, Beyond Vision Casting to Vision Coaching. And so we're going to talk about that. There's a poem right at the beginning of your notes. If you look at that, it says, "All men dream, but not equally. Those who dream by night in the dusty recesses of their minds awake to find that it was vanity. But the dreamers of day are dangerous men, that they may act their dreams with open eyes to make it possible." I've underlined those last two lines because that's really what we're going to talk about today. That they may act their dreams with open eyes, with open eyes. So a lot of times when we have a vision, we have the idea of something we want to do at the church, a direction we want to go, we go into it not with open eyes. And so what I'm going to share with you today is some of the challenges of implementing a dream, implementing a vision, the normal things that pastors tend to face. So there basically is a problem when we think about this, and the problem is that most of us have an unrealistic idea an unrealistic view of implementing vision. And that unrealistic view looks like this, and that is that most of the time when we get excited about a new direction of the church, a dream, a vision, we typically call it, we feel as though we're just going to move from one point to a higher point to a higher point to a higher point. It's just going to be kind of a straight, smooth line from the casting of the vision, the communicating of the vision, to its accomplishment. But of course, that isn't the way it works at all, is it? Vision is often derailed, but it's usually derailed in the implementation stage. So as we begin to implement a vision, it usually begins to be derailed. And it's derailed by what we call typically the deadly deeds. And the deadly deeds are Satan seeking to divide the people of God, to divert us from our mission, our direction, to derail us from what we're trying to do, to discourage us, and to demoralize us. And boy, haven't we seen that in the last 4 or 5 years. I mean, the things that pastors have faced that have divided our congregations is just amazing. You know, I think this started, I think, with Trump versus Biden. And then it was Black Lives Matter versus All Lives Matter. And then it was, do you vaccinate or non-vaccinate? Do you meet or not meet? I mean, didn't we face all this? I mean, this is stuff from all across the United States. As a pastor, if you tried to take a middle road, you got criticized from both sides. Well, why don't you take a stand, the pastor? If you take one side, of course, half your congregation's on the other side. And then, so you go to one side of those issues, and then half your people are on the other side of the issue. So if you take the other side of the issue, half your people are on the other side. I mean, it's been one of those situations. Talk about Satan seeking to divide the Church of God. And all of this diverts us from our mission because we get caught up in all this social engagement and discussions and all this, and takes us away from evangelism, right? It's not surprising to me that so many churches aren't doing evangelism, as Tom Rainer mentioned. It derails us from what we're trying to do and accomplish as a church. And then, of course, we end up being discouraged and demoralized, as we've all probably seen the reports out of Lifeway and other places about how discouraged pastors typically are. Well, this is Satan's doing. And of course, in the larger church, he's seeking to divide us and divert us. But in each of our local churches, he seeks to divide and to divert us too. So when these challenges come, it's not unusual that what we find is that the implementation of the vision looks more like this than it does the first one. But we always are in hopes and excitement, and when we're attached to a particular vision or a dream of what we hope for the church, we hope that we can have that smooth sail kind of right up from the beginning to the end, but it looks much more like this. So what are some insights from this? We'll look at this a little bit during our next session, but we look at Joseph, and this is the way Joseph's life is oftentimes mapped out. Joseph had a vision, as you recall, but he was thrown in the pit, you know, by his brothers. He was sold as a slave in the palace. He was thrown in the prison, bang, 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 up and down. Go back, you've read it, you've preached it probably about Joseph, but look at his life. Joseph's move from the beginning when he had a vision to when it was eventually fulfilled, this is the way it looked. And that's the way most of our visions are going to look if we have a dream that we want to implement in our church. It's not going to be that straight line. It's going to be up and down, up and down, up and down. And that is Satan's doing a lot. And it says Satan attacks, and there's these ups and downs. But it's not all Satan. Sometimes it's our own doing, too. So we're going to look at some insights here. So on your notes, it says insight number one, vision usually stalls after a good start. So we need to just have open eyes. Go back to that poem, that we may act their dreams with open eyes to make it possible. We need to have open eyes when we go into establishing, implementing a dream. One of those open eyes is to realize that a dream always begins with excitement. It begins well, but it always stalls. It always stalls. It will stall. Yours will stall. You just expect it and go into it with that open eyes that it's going to stall. Now, this is a picture that comes aptly from athletics, and this has to do with like weightlifting or long distance running, but it also affects things like if we commit to losing weight or eating healthy, a diet or something like that. Typically, we always begin well, right? We want to exercise, so we begin exercising, or we want to eat healthy, so we begin eating healthy. You know, we say we're going to get on a weight regimen, lift some weights, and, you know, build up our strength, and we start out well. But what happens is when you start out, eventually, even though things are going well for a week or a month or so, it creates stress. Stress creates a tiredness, and we have to rest, and we have to recover, and then we go back up again, and we adapt a bit. You know, if you're, for instance, if you're trying to eat better, to lose weight, a few years ago I had a heart attack, and I weighed 197, I think, at the time, and the doctor said you need to lose about 40 pounds, which I have, actually. Don't I look good? Well, when you've had a heart attack, you wake up a little bit, you know. But, yeah, so I started eating better, but then, you know, you're cutting out salt and you're eating healthier and stuff like that, and you have to, pretty soon you get tired of that, and there's that kind of a dip, and maybe you eat wrong a little bit, but eventually you adapt and adjust your eating habits. And if you're exercising, eventually, you know, you exercise for a while, your muscles get tired, maybe you miss a few times of exercising or something, but eventually you adapt and adjust, and your body adjusts, and you're able then to go further up on the chart. But again, you hit stress again, creates a tiredness in you. You have to get your rest and recovery and adapt. That's the way life typically is, and it's the way it is with the vision implementation too. You have a dream, you have that idea, you start implementing it in the church. It begins well, but then you run into barriers. The barriers cause stress. sometimes we get moody, we get tired, sometimes we back away from implementing the vision. Hopefully we're able to recover, to adapt, and then move on implementing the vision. But there's these series of ups and downs that you have, just like we saw in Joseph's life there. There's these series of ups and downs as you implement a vision. We need to expect that. And as I said here on your notes, it says, remember, when the first shot is fired, all plans change. When you go into battle, you always remember the general's intent, adapt, and overcome. So a lot of times our plans, the ideas we have to be adapted, they have to be adjusted. And as they are, we recover and we keep moving forward towards the ultimate plan that we had for our vision. But just expect this is normal in every phase of life, to start out well and then have that initial drop. Secondly, vision will run into opposition of all sorts. Your vision will run into opposition. Expect opposition to occur. And here are the main things that I've discovered that we run into as pastors when we try and implement a new vision or dream. One is that we encounter negative forces. One of those is criticism. A lot of times we begin to do something and people will begin to criticize you. A lot of times the criticism is not true, but it's criticism nonetheless. It hurts. They criticize our values, our motives, the reasons that we're doing the new thing, whatever it is. Sometimes there's personnel issues or contextual issues. Every church is in a different context, and sometimes we run into things that are contextually related to the location our church is in, or the culture of our people, or something that we didn't realize, and we couldn't even foresee it. I remember having a vision one time. I wanted to lead our church to purchase some property next to the church. So there's a building there, and we were maxing out our children's areas. We had no ability to continue to grow because we didn't have any ability to continue to take care of children. We had no space for children. And I saw this building next door that we could purchase and expand our children's ministry. And so, I led the church in, connecting with the realtor, looking at the property. We set up days when we had elders in our church, so our elders went over and looked at it, and then we had our ministry leaders look at the property, and then we had a Sunday when everybody in the church was able to go through the property and everything. And along the way, all of a sudden this criticism starts up that, well, Pastor Gary, he only wants to get this building so he can have a bigger office. And, that just literally, proverbially blew me away. I thought, I hadn't mentioned an office, I hadn't talked about an office, so where in the world is this criticism coming from? That Gary doesn't want, or he wants this building just because he wants an office, crazy stuff. But this happens, and so you have these negative forces that always kind of rise up. There's blaming sometimes that goes on, particularly when there's that dip, the vision starts. Everybody's excited, everybody thinks it's gonna go forward, and then there's that downward trend, and all of a sudden people start blaming. Well, it's the board's fault, or it's, the classic is it's the pastor's fault, or they'll say things like, it's the consultant's fault, particularly if he hired a consultant. And the only reason churches hire consultants, by the way, is so they have someone to blame when it's all over, and that's okay. As a consultant, I always keep my airline ticket very close to my chest pocket, so I can get out of town when I need to. But seriously, they do, They hire a consultant, and if it works, then the pastor and the leaders can say, yes, that's just what we thought. If it doesn't work, they can say, McIntosh, he didn't know what he was talking about. That's okay. That's what consultants get paid for. Divert the blame a bit. But there is blaming that happens. And then there's always theological justifications for the drop-off. Things like, well, Satan attacked us, and maybe he did. Maybe that's possible. Or they'll say something like, God never wanted us to do this in the first place, so they question the origination of the vision. And then there's always a lack of foreseeing and managing obstacles. There's always going to be obstacles that pop up that we didn't see, didn't think about, and we didn't really manage well. Another thing is the vision must be reinforced upon the minds and hearts of the people. Has to be constantly reinforced upon the minds and the hearts of the people. A lot of times when we have a dream or a vision, we get into the pulpit, we preach our vision, we maybe talk to our board about it, maybe talk to some of the leaders in the church about it, but we really don't take the time to really make sure that they're on board with the vision, that they understand the vision. And what happens is over time they tend to forget it. Essentially, people tend to forget the vision, and the people in your church, they tend to forget your vision in about 1 week. It's something you think about a lot, but they don't think about a lot. They hear it on Sunday, they forget about it during the week. Your ministry staff may, or your ministry leaders may forget it in about 2 weeks. Your elders, deacons, trustees, your paid staff may forget it in a month. Now, the bottom line is we've got to continue to communicate our vision. We got to continue to do it, and we need to do it in a visual way. The word vision actually is a seeing word. When we say vision, it's something that we see. You know, we're seeing the future of the church. And yet when we communicate it, a lot of times we communicate it in a verbal way, but not a visual way. And what we need to do is we need to learn how to take our vision and to express it in a way that is visual. And I got a couple of illustrations that I pulled off the internet and one out of a book, but I think they just illustrate. These are illustrations that come from the secular world, but these particular men are good at creating vision for the future. And one of these is Pat Riley. Pat Riley, you may remember, was the coach of the Los Angeles Lakers for a number of years and was very successful there. And he was being interviewed shortly after he resigned from the Lakers to go to the New York Knicks. And he wrote a book about that period of time in his life. And I found this and I thought, this is just really a good illustration of how you take a vision and you begin to put it into a visual format. So this is what he says. This is right out of his book. The book is called The Winner Within, if you want to get it. But he says, back when I had resigned from the Lakers, I had jogged on the beach every day for the whole summer. As I ran, I imagined myself becoming the New York Knicks coach. I knew, given the team's up and down record, that change was likely. Turnover among NBA coaches is brutal, isn't it, Sam? My jogalogs, he calls it, got real specific. I even thought out my conversations with the players. I knew how I was going to challenge Patrick Ewing and Charles Oakley to help build an unselfish core. So he's jogging in the summer, thinking about this next position, but he's also thinking about how he's going to talk to each individual player, what he's going to say. So he's analyzing who those players are, what motivates them, how he needs to communicate his vision for the future of the next, with each of those players. And he's doing this in the summer. He hasn't even been hired yet, but he's dreaming. Say, he's dreaming, he's thinking, he's envisioning this. He says, I envisioned how I would talk to each player to try to motivate them away from the way they were being perceived, how I had underlined pride, dignity, and integrity to bring the group together. That was my vision of the future, my own personal mission motivation. Now, eventually he did get hired as the next coach in 1991. And this is what he says. When I sat down and talked to Patrick Ewing and his wife, Rita, I told him about how I had spent a whole month envisioning it And how I also visualize one day a parade going down Broadway with confetti snowing down on the canyon of skyscrapers. People cheering from the curbs wearing t-shirts boasting Nick Power back to back. And I told him one day it's going to happen to this franchise. I don't care what somebody else thinks. I believe it's going to happen. Now, it never happened. Never happened. But in the book, he talks about this. He went to Patrick Ewing's house, sat down in the living room with Patrick Ewing and his wife. And he actually said, Patrick and Rita, close your eyes and just imagine with me that you're riding in an open convertible car down Broadway in New York with those skyscrapers up high, and raining down on us is confetti because we've won the NBA championship. And as you look over on the curbs, there's people wearing t-shirts saying Nick Power back to back and cheering and everything. So what was he doing? He's visualizing for the player, this is my vision for the future. He just didn't go in and say, well, my vision is that we're going to win the NBA. Okay. Well, that was the NBA. That was the vision to win the championship. But what he did is he created a way to talk about it in a way that helped visualize it for the player himself. I'm going to bypass the other illustration here. It's a very similar type of illustration. But as pastors, we've got to realize that our people are going to forget the vision. And we can come up with that nice little phrase that we put on banners and we put it on the posters and we put it on church letterhead and we put it on bulletins and programs and stuff, and that just doesn't get it done. Just doesn't get it done. There's a lot of churches I've been to that have beautiful banners hanging in the auditorium with their vision statement on it, and it has done absolutely nothing for the church. And what we have to do is we have to learn to communicate in the visual way. We have to be able to visualize what would it look like if our vision took place. What would it look like? What would it feel like? What would it smell like? And then we need to share that with people. So like if we have cake and ice cream with, Nellie, that faithful older saint at church who always is there, always supportive, always a prayer warrior in the church, and we go and visit her maybe every month for some ice cream or something, and we sit there, and we need to be able to say, Nellie, what do you see the future of our church being, or what do you see the future vision for our church? And Nellie's going to sit back and say, well, Pastor, I really haven't thought about it. You know, I don't know. Well, Nellie, just think about it right now. Where do you see our church being in 5 years? And I'd just like to hear what you think. And then you sit back and you let Nellie talk. And you listen to her and you reflect with her. But when she's done, you got to be ready. And you say, well, Nellie, I've been thinking about this for a long time. You know, I've been jogging on the sand or whatever you do, you know. I've been swimming in the pool. I've been going for my nature walks. I've been praying, and I believe I have an idea of what God wants for our church in the future. Would you mind if I share this with you? And what is Nellie going to say? She's going to say, well, sure, Pastor, I'd like to know what you think about the future of our church. Now, at that point, you got to sit back and say, Nellie, close your eyes. Just imagine with me that, you know, you come up to our church, and as you come up to our church, you look to your right, and there's a young family over there with a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old, and you look over here, and there's another young family with a 2-year-old and a baby and a little carry basket that they're bringing in the church, and there's greeters out there welcoming people and directing them to the nursery, and when you walk in, there's soft music playing, and there's the rustle of paper, and the people are talking in conversation, and we've got a little coffee area over here, and people are over there having fellowship around coffee. And as you walk down the hall, you peek in the nursery, and lo and behold, our nursery, it's got an overflow number of children in the nursery, something that we haven't seen for years, but it's so exciting to look in there and see this. Nellie, can you imagine that with me? See, that's what you got to do. And I'm just making all that up, but I don't know what your vision is, I don't know what your dream is, but you've got to take that vision, that dream, And you've got to visualize it verbally so you can sit there with an elder or a deacon or a trustee over breakfast, lunch, or dinner and say to, Deacon Brad, tell me, where do you think our church is going to be in the next 5 years? And Brad will say, Pastor, I really haven't given it much thought. Well, just think about it now. Give me some ideas. Listen to Brad. Reflect with Brad. When Brad's done, you say, Brad, thanks for sharing that. There's some good ideas there. Brad, I've been thinking and praying about this for a long time. Would you mind if I share with you what I think God wants? And Brad's going to say, well, sure, Pastor, I want to know. Brad, just close your eyes with me here and just dream. Just think about this. What if, and you tell that story. Now, what you do is you tell that story all the time. Every time you meet with people, every time you meet with a Sunday school class, every time you speak at a small group or something, you tell that same story. It's the same story. It's your story. Don't change the story. Keep telling the story. One of the famous men from years ago, his name is Donald McGavran. Some of you may know that name. Some of you probably don't. But McGavran is the one who had been a missionary in India for 31 years. And he came to the United States, and he was sharing the principles of evangelism, and those principles eventually were called the Church Growth Principles. Both Tom Rainer and I kind of were cut our teeth as younger pastors through the Church Growth Movement, so McGavran was a famous person. Well, McGavran was heavily criticized, and what they criticized him for is they said, McGavran has one string on his violin. And that's all he plays. And that string was the importance of evangelism, making disciples, new disciples, not just better old disciples. Not the old disciples, better disciples, but finding new people out of the mass of secular humanity and leading them to faith in Christ through conversion evangelism. And every time I heard McGavran speak, and I heard him speak many times, he always spoke on Matthew 28, the Great Commission, over and over and over. It was the same message. It was different sometimes, but it was the same message underneath. It was always. And his criticism was, McGavran, you've just got one string on your violin. That's it. Well, hey, you've got to keep sharing your vision until people say to you, Pastor, I'm sick and tired of that. You talk about that all the time. Now, if they start saying that to you, then maybe you're beginning to get it across, but you got to do that. So on C here, I said, remember, you have only one string on your violin. What is that? Your string is your vision. It's your dream. Whatever that vision or dream is, however you have chosen to state it and communicate it, you need to keep communicating it. It's your one string violin from the pulpit. One-on-one, in small groups, you keep doing it. Because if you don't, people will forget it. But as you keep doing it, people will eventually understand what you're doing. Fourth thing here, letter D, is vision will only survive through skilled negotiations of four major barriers. So you have to help coach or negotiate these four major barriers. And these are on the back side of your notes. So barrier number one, these are the typical barriers that pop up when you're implementing a vision. The first one is lack of honest buy-in by the people in your church. Lack of honest buy-in. Now I'm talking here about buy-in from your board, your deacons, your elders, whatever you call it, board of trustees, whatever you have in your church. There's a lack of honest buy-in from them. If you have paid staff, there's sometimes a lack of honest buy-in from the staff. And of course, your key people, your key ministry leaders. I ran into this with wanting to buy that property I mentioned back next to our church. I had a board of elders. I think we had 8 or 10 elders at the time. I can't remember exactly now. But we had this little thing where when we would discuss something of a major importance, we'd go around the room, and each elder would go thumbs up, they were for it, thumbs down, they were against it, or thumbs sideways, meaning they wanted to discuss it more. So we had gone through this process with the realtor looking at this property and everything. We were a Baptist church. You understand Baptist churches, don't you, how they operate? I think you do. But we had to vote on practically everything, of anything significant, at least. And so we had to go to the congregation to get the authority to purchase this building, obviously. So before we took it to the congregation, we were sitting in the room in church where the board met, and I went around individually to each board member, and I looked at them, called them by name, and I said, thumbs up, thumbs down, or do you want to talk about it some more? Every one of those elders did a thumbs up with a big smile. We're for this, Pastor, we're for this. Well, we eventually took it to the church, and we lost the vote. We lost the vote by one vote, by one vote. It was devastating. It was devastating. Later on, I heard that four of my elders voted no. And I'm perplexed, you know. Each one of them in front of the other elders said, we're for it, Pastor, thumbs up. Every one of them. There were no thumbs down, there were no sideways thumbs. They were all up. And I'm thinking, what's going on here? Well, lack of honest buy-in. They obviously had some concerns. They obviously had some misgivings. Some thought I wanted a bigger office. You know, I guess. I don't know. But they weren't willing to talk about it. Now, there's more to the story than that, but you know, when you lose by one vote and four of your elders vote no, it's just, if three of them had voted no and one more yes, we would have won. It's just crazy, you know. But lack of an honest buy-in. And sometimes that happens with staff, if you have paid staff. Sometimes they'll say, yes, Pastor, I'm for this, but then they're really not. And so, you know, they're on staff, they're being paid, but they're really not with you on this. And even if they don't verbally speak against you, which, you know, would be dishonorable, really, but they still may not work towards it with energy and with excitement, things like that. So, and then you've got your key people. So a lot of times there's just a lack of honest buy-in. Sometimes there's stalled negotiations. Sometimes when you want to do something that's quite large in terms of vision, you know, you have to negotiate with people in the church, maybe negotiate with a small group class, or negotiate with a power family in the church, or negotiate with a key Sunday school class or something like that. And if you can't negotiate agreements to the direction you want to go, sometimes you just can't get there. I know I pastored a church with a power family, and if that power family was on my side, I could do things. When they weren't on my side, I couldn't do anything. Because again, we had to have votes, and they controlled the vote. You know, I didn't control the vote, they controlled the vote. Right or wrong, they did. So I had to make sure as much as possible they were with me on the side of the new vision, the new direction. And sometimes if we don't have that, then we can't move forward. And so we've got to work very hard as much as we can to make sure that we can have the good, honest buy-in with our board members, with our staff. I think that means individual conversations sometimes, not just sitting at a board meeting like I did saying thumbs up. because maybe for some reason they were embarrassed to say they had concerns or something in front of the other elders. Who knows? You know, it might have been better if I had taken each one of them out for breakfast or something and said, now, Bill, tell me honestly, are you with me? You know, are you with this, with the rest of the elders on this? You know, staff members having serious face-to-face conversations. Are you really on board, you know, and having those kind of conversations? But somehow or other, we need to work hard to get as much buy-in as we can and get the best negotiations we can. Another wall of opposition is misunderstanding the concept of change and transition. We don't have time to talk a lot about this today, but change is the surface things that we want to do in the church, and they're very visible. But in, every time you make a change visibly, there's always underneath that the relational aspects that impact people. And so you may want to change the music in the church, but that's going to impact people somehow or other. You may want to say go to two church services versus one. Well, how is that going to impact the people in the nursery? Or how is that going to impact the people in the choir or the music team, the praise team, who now have to sing two services versus one, things like that. A lot of times in our excitement to move forward with change, vision, dreaming always involves some level of change in the church. We're excited about that, but we forget to think about how it's really going to impact the people in the church. Well, then when it impacts them in a negative way, then they come out in opposition to the church. So these are just some things we have to think about, is this wall of opposition. But then number two is what we call the wall of success. So what happens if it really works? What if your dream really works? What if it goes through and it works? And all of a sudden, instead of having 100 people at church, you have 200 people at church. Or what happens if all of a sudden, instead of having one or two babies in the nursery, you have 20 babies in the nursery? You know, are you prepared for that? A lot of times we're not. And to tell you the truth, as a young pastor, some of the stuff I implemented at church worked, and I wasn't prepared for the increase. I wasn't ready for it. And then, of course, that causes it to stall out. And then it declines, and then to scramble and try and catch up again, sometimes it's too late. So what if it works? You know, are you going to need new workers? You know, if our nursery goes from 2 children to 20 children, how many more workers do I need? Am I preparing those workers now before I need them? Because once I have 20 children in the nursery, I can't now go back and train, you know, 4 more or 5 more or 6 more or 8 more workers for the nursery. I got to be thinking ahead. What if this works? You know, what do I need? How many more are we going to have to do new policies? We need new programs, new leaders, new small groups, new Sunday school classes, you know. What if this dream actually works? What am I going to need? I need to start preparing for that now. And what I've discovered, this whole thing of prayer that Tom was talking about during the second break is so true. You know, if we start preparing the nursery, we remodel it, prepare it, get it ready for more babies, and we start praying and asking God to send us more babies, He usually does. But are we prepared with more workers than to serve? So part of our faith is that we pray for more babies, we prepare for more babies by remodeling and upgrading the nursery, but then we also start training some new nursery workers to be prepared to go in there when we have the extra babies. And that takes faith, because we're preparing them and we don't have the babies. You know, we're preparing more small group leaders, but we don't have the small groups yet. But we're anticipating God's going to bless us and bring them in. But we've got to prepare for that. And this is what we call the pyramid principle in church growth. For any particular church, you've got to have a certain base to support a certain size of church. So you have a pyramid. The size of a pyramid is directly proportional to the base of the pyramid. So the wider the base, the higher the pyramid can be. And you can do this yourself if you take, you know, you get some sand and you take a piece of paper like this and you just pour sand on it, a pyramid will develop. And it'll keep getting higher and higher until what? Till the sand starts falling off the edges, right? And then it won't matter how much more sand you put on top, the pyramid stays the same because the sand just rolls off the side. So in order to get the pyramid higher, you've got to have a bigger base. So you take a table like this and start pouring sand on it, you can get a higher pyramid before the sand starts pulling off the sides of it. So in order to really see a church continue to grow, if you add more people, you've got to expand that base. So this is where we have to have more workers in the nursery. We have to have more small group leaders, more Sunday school teachers, more greeters. And essentially a church grows at a rate of about 10 people to every single leader in the church. So a church of 100 will typically have about 10 leaders in the church. And a church of 100 will typically have one pastor. They'll have maybe two or three deacons and maybe six or seven teachers or small group leaders. And that's the leaders in the church. And if we want to see 200 people in the church, we've got to have 20 leaders in the church. And so we got to be thinking ahead about this. And what if our vision works? If it works, we got to be prepared. And so we got to prepare ahead of time in anticipation of what God's going to do. And then as God brings the people in, then we're prepared and the vision doesn't stall out. I got to move along here. I'm getting a wave from the back that I got to get going. So barrier number three is the wall of diverted energy. So if your vision is working, typically what happens is you may get diverted by other things that are going to take your time. For instance, facility expansion, capital campaigns, loan negotiations, new criticisms. There's always going to be new, fresh criticisms that get thrown your way. Gary, he just wants an office, you know, wants a bigger office. Setting boundaries. We have to set some boundaries on our time and make sure that we can continue to focus on the vision. Because, again, Satan wants to divert us from that vision. And one of the ways he diverts us is by taking our attention away from focusing on accomplishing the vision to putting it off on these other good things out there. So this is in the book that was just given away, the 10 Key Roles of a Pastor, if you want a full explanation of this. But this is basically how Jesus devoted his time. We know that in the Gospels, not every moment of Jesus' life on earth is given. There's select pictures of Jesus in the Gospels. But when you look at the Gospels, basically Jesus gave about 70% of his time to his primary leaders, his VIPs, his very important people. That was the disciples. And he gave about 15% of his time to what we might think of as secondary leaders, very trainable people. That was like the 70 or the 500 we would think of in the scripture. And then there was the very nice people. That was like the feeding the 5,000. Very nice people. We would think of that today as our congregation, a larger congregation. And then the very DPs down the bottom, the critics, the VDPs, the very training people, the Sadducees, the Pharisees. Jesus really gave very little time to his critics. Now, we have to listen to our critics, but we have to, as I said earlier in the notes, you can look at it, you have to weigh your critics, don't count them. Some critics are more important to listen to than others. And so we have to know which critics are really the good critics. And we do need to listen to them. But we have to be careful to make sure that we're investing a lot of time with our leaders and making sure that they're on board with us with the vision, and not getting diverted away from that. The other wall of that we have to deal with is the wall of crisis. So there will always be various crises that come up when we do a vision implementation. We'll have leadership defection, we'll have new negotiations that we have to make. There'll be people who promise us things, but they don't fulfill them. There'll be unexpected challenges. We ourselves will get involved in serious soul searching. You know, when things don't go smoothly or don't go the way we think they should, we're going to find ourselves seriously praying and thinking about what went wrong. Was the vision correct? Did we get ahead of God? These are just things that we have to think about and we have to manage as we go along. So the basic thing that I'm saying today is the vision will die unless it's facilitated and coached to completion. there's going to be those ups and downs, and we've got to, you know, work through those ups and downs to completion. So just in the last slide there real quickly, one way that we can really help facilitate the vision is to start with a team. You know, if you have a dream or a vision for the future, don't start it by yourself. Make sure that you get a team of people around you, and make sure that those people balance you. So in my case, I'm a big picture person, so around me I need to have detailed people who can think about the next steps in order to accomplish things. Maybe you're the type of pastor that can think about the big picture but also do the next steps. If you are, God bless you, but most of the time, if you have a vision, you need people around you to help make sure that the vision gets through. Well, we need to find those people and get them around us first as much as possible. So what I say is we need to see some practitioners who see the process and the obstacles. We need to plan through each barrier. Think ahead. If one of my elders defects from this vision, how am I going to handle it? You know, assume that one of your leaders is going to leave. Assume that one of your staff members is going to disagree with the vision. Okay, when they do, what's your step? How are you going to handle that? You know, think ahead about that, each of those barriers, and think through what the challenge might be and how you might be prepared to answer it. You know, what are you going to say? What are you going to do? How are you going to lead through it? So it doesn't catch you by surprise. Prepare for resistance, expect some resistance, expect criticism. You know, you can look at the scripture, there was always criticism. You look at Nehemiah and what he did, he was criticized and attacked, and verbally attacked and physically attacked and everything, you know. And you gotta think ahead. You know, we're gonna have some resistance. Where's the resistance likely to come from? Who is it likely to come from? What have they done before? People who resist in the church typically have done it before. So what have they done before? What have they said before? You know, have your answer prepared. Know what you're going to do when they do resist. And then simply coach it to completion. This is coaching. You're casting your vision. You're talking to people. You're leading forth, and you're managing these things ahead of time so they don't catch it by surprise, and you don't get discouraged by those dips. They are going to come. And just be prepared for them, adapt along the way, and just keep moving forward. Most people give up too soon. I'm now in my 40, I see, what is it, since 1983, how many years has that been? 40 years almost of consulting with churches. I left my last pastorate in 83 and went into church consulting and teaching in a seminary. And over and over again, I've seen that pastors quit too soon, and the resistance, the pushback on the vision usually subsides in 6 or 7 years. And you think, 6 or 7 years? Yeah, 6 or 7 years. A lot of times it takes 6 or 7 years before people really, truly get on board. But as you know, and I know, most pastors leave their church in 4 or 5 years. You know, even today, maybe pastors stay a little longer than 4 or 5 years, but usually they leave by year 6. And a lot of times pastors leave right before there is the turnaround that happens. And so we just got to coach the vision, continue to prepare, think ahead, you know, be prepared for these things, and just keep going. You know, make sure you've only got one violin. And on that violin, there's only one string, all right? Well, God bless you. And again, I'm sorry I can't stick around and talk, but we'll talk by email if you want, all right? God bless.